Session number 28624, Rule 5.
Good morning, it's session 3 and I'm back with Mr. Kinghorn. Good morning again, Mr. Kinghorn.
Good morning.
The last time we left off, you had just went to Fort George and you were just joining the Gordon Highlanders. When you went to Fort George, were you issued with uniform again? Because you spoke about handing in your uniform and your kit at the training college.
That's right. Yes, we left everything behind at Mons. What I had picked up in between was my kilt, my number two jacket, my green doublet, and all the various parts of the uniform that I would be taking with me to the battalion. The only thing I was issued with at Fort George was just some working combat clothes, because I was going to be there for such a short time, there was no requirement for anything else. And basically what you do in that short time is just learn how to turn yourself out properly in your new uniform. And the combat stuff is just something you're going to use if you were perhaps assisting a training officer on the range with his squad or whatever.
Okay. And the combat issue that you were given, was that the one we associate now with like the green, different colours of green and brown?
Yes, that's right. The only difference now is that it is the camouflage thing, so you've got a number of mottled colours, the browns and the greens and so on. In those days, the combat outfit was just a straight green, so they've advanced a little, but that's all that I was given to work there.
Okay. And did you have your Gordon Highlanders officer's uniform by then?
Yes, I did. I picked that up at William Jardine and Company, who were the regimental tailors in 4th Street in Edinburgh. I collected all that, but of course you do need a little bit of assistance in how to wear it. I got that because the adjutant at the Highland Brigade, at the depot then, it wasn't Highland Brigade quite, it was a joint depot between Queenstown Highlanders and Gordons, was Angus Avery, now deceased, but a very nice chap. He was captain and adjutant, and being a Gordon Highlander, he was able to put me absolutely right, show me how to wear my sporran at the correct height, where to put the kilt pin in, how to roll down my lover toes, and various other things that you have to learn.
Okay. And did you find it easy, or was it difficult?
No, that was easy. Once you've been, you only need to be shown once, and it's straightforward after that. And apart from anything else, the kilt pin never comes out except for cleaning, and you know, it's very straightforward.
Is there a reason why the kilt pin never comes out?
No. I suppose if you took it out, there's a chance you'd lose it, but it just seems to belong in the kilt. No, there it stands. You take it out every now and again to polish it, but back it goes. And the hole marks become permanent anyhow. You know, you don't have to look for it there. Once it's been in there for some time, the hole marks are absolutely permanent.
Okay. And is there anything special about the officer's kilt?
There is a distinction between the officer's kilt and the jock's kilt insofar as, from memory, the jocks have a yellow stripe that runs down the centre of their front apron, and the officer's one doesn't. It has nothing in the centre and yellow stripes to either side. It's just a different set, but same tartan, of course.
And did the army issue you with this, you know, so you went to the tailors, or did you have to pay for it?
No, you pay for your uniform. The army issues you with combat kit and the equipment, but your number two jacket, your green doublet, everything else, your kilt, your tartan trews, all of those things are bought by the young officer, who receives a grant, I have to say. I mean, you get a uniform allowance, which didn't nearly cover it, but you do pay for it yourself.
Okay. Is there special occasions when you would wear the trews?
Yeah, crews were worn from memory on Saturday mornings for some reason. I don't know. I mean, it would be published, really, and there was a tradition that if you were in barracks, you would be in number two dress, kilt. Saturday mornings, for some reason, you wore trews. There was a mess undress code of dress which involved trews. Your mess kit was actually your red doublet with kilt, but there was a mess undress code which meant trews.
Okay, and was there special things that you had to wear in the mess, or could you just go in the mess in your combats?
During the day, whatever you were dressed in was acceptable to go into the mess. And you know, as you work in companies, you know, one company might be having a day in barracks and doing a lot of classroom work and that sort of thing, and you would be in your kilt. Another company might have a more different sort of, they might be on the range, they might be on the assault course, you might be doing all sorts of things, and you might be in combat kit. You weren't all within the battalion doing the same thing and all dressed alike. You worked, you dressed according to your company routine that day. So during the day, yes, if you had time to go to the mess for coffee break, which often one did, then you went along in whatever you were wearing. That was perfectly acceptable.
But the evening, was that different?
Evening, yes. And evening, of course, unless there was a particular special dinner which involved mess kit or mess undress, you would be in civilian clothes. So, you know, you could stay, I think the timing usually was about 6 o'clock. Up to 6 o'clock, you were in the mess wearing whatever you had been wearing that day anyway. After that, you know, you would go off and change and come back in a blazer and flannels or whatever.
Okay. And when you received, you know, once you went into the regiment and you got your kilt and your jacket and everything, did you actually look after that, or did you have someone who looked after it for you?
In the short period of time that I was at Fort George for, I looked after my own kit, had to. But when you joined your unit, joined the battalion, and took command of a platoon, you were allocated a batman, and he helped you with your kit. He organised the cleaning of that. But at Fort George, looked after it. But such a short period of time, there wasn't a great deal to do.
And do you remember your first impressions of Fort George?
Yes, I do. And I fell in love with it right away. It was just the most wonderful place, and I was very pleased after my tour in Kenya, when I was appointed a training officer at the depot. The depot subsequently moved to Bridger Don Barracks in Aberdeen, Gordon Barracks, Bridger Don, Aberdeen. But for 6 months I was at Fort George, but I had fallen in love with it right away. It's just the most tranquil, wonderful place. I mean, it's just a glorious place to be. It's my favourite army barracks throughout.
And is it like a traditional, what you would think of a traditional barracks, or is that a very old building or quite a new building?
It was built at the time after the after Culloden, when the English forces occupied much of Scotland. Duke of Cumberland, I suppose, was the English commander of the forces, and he built the forts such as Fort Augustus, Fort George, Fort William. I can't think of any others at the moment. So, you know, it's something like 250 years old, but it's just a wonderful place with its ramparts, and you get into it through an archway. It's such a secure fortress, precisely what it is, but there's a huge tranquility to it, and of course it's on the point there at Ardersierge, in a wonderful part of the world, looking across to the Black Isle. Lovely. Okay.
And when you started, I remember you saying that there was one other officer came from the training college with you. Was there an intake of officers then, or was it just yourself?
No, the chap I refer to is Bob Gerard, whose father had once commanded the 1st Battalion soon after the war. And it just was coincidental that there were two Gordon Hounders at the time. I mean, there might have been none, there might have been one. It wasn't really an intake, it was just a situation where there were two of us at the time. But that was probably typical. Sandhurst, I remember the my chums that I served with, they seemed to arrive in pairs, but that's not a set thing. There might be no one at all in the intake, might be one, might be two, never be more than that.
Okay. And now you were an officer, will you describe to us the type of accommodation you were given at Fort Rowley?
At Port George, sorry.
Yes, well, the two of us
shared a room. Bob and I both shared a room on the ground floor of the mess there, and it's typical of the place. They were big rooms, fairly high ceilings, and what I do remember, and it hadn't changed when I came back 2 years later or whatever the time was, the heating was not radiators such as we know now, but a pipe that would run the length of one of your walls, and it never seemed to sleep, that pipe. It was always rumbling away, and when the heating went off at night, I don't know what time it went off, probably 10 or 11, you would hear it cooling down. It was making all sorts of sounds, and then when it came on in the morning, it was expanding and the hot air going through it. It was a well-known system, the heating at Port George. But we just shared a room. All the rooms came off corridors, and at some point along the corridor there would be the communal showers and latrines and so on. So, nice room.
Do you remember which time of the year? What time of the year it was?
Let me see now. I think it would have been, it was certainly spring. It was probably around about April, I think. Winter had passed. Yes, it was probably April, I think. And
okay.
There for a week or 10 days.
And was the rest of the battalion there?
No, the battalion had already gone out to Kenya. So this was just a training depot for new recruits who would be going either to the Queensland Highlanders or the Gordons in due course after their basic training. So the battalion was already stationed in Gilgil in Kenya.
And at what point did you find out that you'd be going out to join them?
Oh, I'd known that for quite some time. Once I heard, when I'd been at Mons after Cadet School, well into the second half of the course there, had my interview with Colonel Fort, and then a few days later heard that I'd been accepted into the regiment, then I knew that as soon as I'd completed Mons, had a little bit of leave, and I would be waiting for a flight out to the battalion. So I'd known for some 3 months, I would think.
And how did you feel about that?
Oh, I was very excited. I just couldn't wait to go to Kenya. East Africa has a great call for everyone, and just couldn't wait.
Okay. And was there any preparations that you had for going there, you know, like injections?
Oh, yes, that's true. Yes, of course, I'd forgotten that. Yes, I did. Whatever the injections were, that was all part of it. And there was a full-time medical officer at the training depot at Fort George, so I was given whatever I had to be given, and I can't quite remember what there was.
What about special kit, you know, lightweight kit or anything? Did you receive any of that?
Absolutely not. No, that is something you receive on arrival there. So all I had was my the uniform I've described, the number 2 jacket, doublet, kilt, trews, sporrans, the rest of it. That was what I'd be taking with me. I'd even be handing in my combat suit back to the depot, and then I'd be equipped once I got out to the battalion and the lightweight equipment and everything else.
And did they advise you to read anything before you went about where you were going to, or did you get lectures?
No, not at all. No, the depot was there purely to run as a depot, and they had their job to do. And the fact that every now and again someone would pass through, so to speak, was not a matter for them to concentrate on. No, you were left to your own reading or whatever you wanted to do. There they just taught you the fundamentals of wearing your regimental uniform. And I remember helping out on a rifle range for a couple of days or a weekend, and really the time passed so quickly. You weren't doing a job really, you were just acclimatizing yourself to the way of an officer in a barracks.
Okay. So did the army organize for your transport to Kenya?
Yes, I was given when the posting order came, well, it was waiting for me there, the date, the time of the flight, and that was all that's done for you. And then you get a rail warrant to get you to the airport, and off you go.
Okay, was that London?
Yes, it was, yeah, absolutely.
And did yourself and the other gentleman both go to?
Bob Gerard and I both caught the train from Inverness to London. Yes, we travelled the whole way together, yeah.
And once you got on the flight, did you get any special treatment being an officer? You know, did you get first class or anything?
No, not at all. No, the system of military movements then, and I'm sure now, at all times during my career anyhow, was that you didn't travel in a civilian flight. You travelled in a military charter. I have a recollection that it was Monarch Airlines who had the military contract at that time. It used to go out to tender, and anyone who wanted it would tender for it. I'm sure it was Monarch. But you would go in a flight filled with soldiers, sailors, whatever, RAF, all going out to Nairobi for one reason or another. So no special treatment, they received the same, and just rolled up and got your seat, and off we went.
And was it a direct flight at that point, or was there a stop?
Let me see now. I seem to remember that it was. I can't remember stopping. I might be wrong, but I think it was direct. Yes, I remember stopping when we came back, when I came back from Hong Kong and various other places. But I think the Kenya flight was London to Nairobi straight.
Okay. So once you got to Nairobi, what was your initial impressions of it?
Oh, well, excitement as always, and I remember being met there by the orderly officer of the day, Herbert Gilgill, charming chap called David Henry, who now lives in Florida. He met us in a Land Rover driven by one of the MT platoon drivers. David met us, we bundled into the back of a Land Rover and drove the sort of 70 odd miles it was to Gilgil up country, and just staggered really by the breathtaking scenery and just the rawness of this wonderful country, Kenya. Very exciting indeed.
And was it very hot when you arrived there?
Yes, it would have been hot, yes. Kenya by day is always hot, cools down rapidly at night, but it's hot. And if I'm right about the month being April, very close to that anyhow, the summer was well underway. So they have the same seasons as we do, but of course the equator runs through Kenya, so it's a very hot country.
Okay. And what was your initial impressions of where you were about to live? Was there a camp or something?
Yes, it was. That's about all it was, a camp defined by barbed wire. But I have to say that it was. I was surprised at the low quality of it. I mean, I hadn't been used to high quality because my basic training was in an old wartime camp of hangars, wartime hangars. Mons was not much better, if at all. But this was worse than either of them. I couldn't believe it because in the short time I'd been at Fort George, a wonderful old historic fortress. And here we were in a sort of mud camp, really, with just huts and just a whole lot of huts spread around this fairly large camp. But when it rained, the mud was everywhere, and it really was not second rate, but fourth rate. Terrible place.
Okay, and did you have a hut to yourself?
No. The officer's mess was a little compound to one side of the camp, and there were the mess itself, the public area, was one hut. Then I think the accommodation was divided into three other huts, all built around a sort of little grassy patch, but four huts forming a quad, really. But that hut would have accommodated, I think we were about 17 subalterns in all. There were officers, of course, who were married and lived outside the camp in married quarters, but there were about 17 of us, not in one hut. That would have spread out between two huts.
And had this camp been a long-established camp?
I'm not sure about that. I'm pretty certain that we took it over from the Coldstream Guards, so it had been there. But quite how old it was, I don't know. Not particularly old, I would have thought. It might have existed, I'm surmising now, but it might have been erected to deal with the Mau Mau emergency in the early 50s, which was only a few years before we got there. But No, it wouldn't have been an old camp, but a hurriedly put together camp is how I describe it.
I would have expected you to say tents. You know, it was quite a shock when you said mud huts.
Not mud huts, a lot of mud around, but wooden huts.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yes, no, my mistake. No, simply mud because when it rains very hard. But there weren't sort of tarmac roads or anything like that. There were tracks which really just get beaten up by the rain when it falls. But no, the huts were wooden huts. Yeah.
Sure.
Now, not a tented, because it was a permanent camp, so, but they were single-story wooden huts. Yeah, but a pretty awful place.
And had this been part of the British government's land it was on, do you think?
Well, yes, it would have belonged to the War Office then. War Office then became the Ministry of Defence, of course. But yes, Kenya was a colony at that time, so it was run by a colonial office. But so it would have been their land. They'd have just commandeered it for their purposes.
Okay. And you said that you went out there and you didn't really have much kit. When would they have issued you with that?
Well, the following morning, because I got there on the on a Saturday. We arrived. I remember there was a football match going on, which was had attracted a huge number of people. So when we got there, we just dumped our bags and went to watch this football game. The battalion were playing a guards team, and being at national service period still, there were a lot of national servicemen, and therefore there were a lot of professional footballers playing for both sides, very high standard. That particular game had attracted thousands of locals from far and wide, so it was a big event. So watched that game, then went in, met the adjutant, was told that I was to report to B Company the following morning, a Sunday, to get my, then go to the quartermaster to receive my kit, because on the Monday, that's 2 days later, B Company was going to Zanzibar. So I didn't have very long to meet anyone or get my kit. So I got my kit next day at the QM store, met some, you know, the other officers in B Company, and away at crack of dawn on the Monday.
And how did you feel about being part of the Gordons now? Because you came through such a lot to get to this point. How did you feel?
Oh, yes, well, I think hardly had time to feel anything, I think, because I was surprised to be moving so quickly. But I really was very pleased that it had all worked out, and very, very proud to be a Gordon Highlander. But there wasn't much time for thinking about that. Getting my kit, meeting everyone, it's all quite overwhelming in a sort of way, because suddenly you are part of a big unit. The strength of the Gordons at that time was, I think, we were with all the national servicemen in Swan, and following a very successful recruiting tour before we went out there, I think we were very close to 800 strong.
Okay. And why were they sending you to Zanzibar so quickly?
Well, the reason was that it was B Company's turn. D Company had been sent there because there was an element of political unrest, such as we're reading in the papers today, there still is. The Zanzibar at that time was a protectorate, though it was ruled by the Sultan of Zanzibar. The judiciary was British, and we had an agreement to assist them when and as required, and the Sultan had asked for assistance. Being off the coast of Tanganyika as it was then, the obvious call for assistance would be made to East Africa Command, which was in Nairobi. And so we had a company, it was all that was required. It was a very tiny island, still is, with a small population. And so a company at a time was what we were doing. So we were actually based there for the best part of a year, but D Company, who I hadn't met, of course, because they were actually there, were due to be coming back, and we, B Company, were replacing them. That just happened to be 2 days after I got there. So it was just a straightforward handover from one company to us, and then we would be handing over to A Company 3 months later. So I had, when I went down on the Monday, that was the start of a three-month tour.
Okay. And how many men would be in a company?
That would be about 120, run by Major Angus Tindall, and the second in command was Captain Ewan Gordon, and then the subalterns were Robin Forkus, Christopher Vandenoot, David Jubuli, and myself.
Okay, thank you.